But today we're talking about religion, religion's religious. How do Christians navigate the shift from a place of privilege to that of plurality in a culture where we used to be able to assume that most of the folks around us were going to be Christian, but now today we know that just isn't the case. I grew up in Los Angeles, California. When I was your age, I dated my way through the world's religions. My first girlfriend was a Wiccan. Okay, yeah. Yeah, broke up with her. There was a voodoo doll involved, okay? It's okay, things are all right. My arm only hurts a little bit, okay? My next girlfriend was Buddhist, okay? The Mormon girls were always cute and inviting me to dances at their local stake. I would go, they wouldn't be there. There would be an elder handing me a Book of Mormon. Instead, I guess the girls just weren't that into me. I even dated a Methodist, okay? Oh, exotic, Ken. But I had friends who had all different types of perspectives. I mean, some of my best friends were pastors' kids. Any PKs out there? Any PKs? Right on. Okay, so some of my best friends were PKs, but then one of my other friends, one of my really dear friends, grew up in a Methodist household, but then later converted to Judaism at the end of high school and beginning of university. If you know anything about converting to Judaism, it is not easy. There was a time in his life where he couldn't even shake a woman's hand. Okay, to show his commitment to the process of conversion. Now he lives in Israel. I got to walk with him through that process as we were best friends, learned tons about Judaism from him. Like I said, I had the Wiccan and the Buddhist and the Mormons and everyone else. It was a lovely opportunity to get to know the diversity of the world around me in my high school, in my city where I grew up and I lived. And a couple of my friends were named Amir and Hassan. And Amir and Hassan were just Amir and Hassan. I never really talked to these guys about religion, never really knew what their background was. But then when I was in high school, and I'm gonna date myself a little bit here, it was 2001. And on September 11th, 2001, for those of you who have read in the history books, or if you were around at that point in time and you remember this, Amir and Hassan suddenly became Muslim to me for the very first time. I was trying to piece together, how is it Amir and Hassan, the guys I party with, the guys I play volleyball with, the guys I go surfing with, are part of the same religion as people who just willingly hijacked planes and flew them into buildings and killed thousands of people? How does that jive? And unfortunately, Amir and Hassan had to answer a bunch of questions just like that. And both of them were like, yeah, we're not like Muslim, okay? Like, leave us alone. But they were facing tons of tough questions. And in the midst of this kind of journey to try and understand that, I headed to a local church that was hosting an imam to come and speak about Islam. And this poor guy had a room of about this many people. He was speaking the Saturday after 9/11, just 5 days after this attack. And there was a lot of awkwardness in the room and a lot of animosity and a lot of hard questions. And this imam dealt with it graciously, intelligently. He answered all the questions, sat around afterward for hours talking to people about his faith and his perspective and what happened. And I went up and I talked to him and I said, what do I need to do as a Christian to be able to navigate what's going on in our world? Because I sensed even then that something was changing, that this was going to start a whole new range of conversations and deep questions about what people believe and why and what they do with that belief. And he says, Ken, the best thing you can do is learn about other religions. And that single response literally changed my life. I've gone on to get a degree in religious studies. I have a PhD in Islamic studies. I spend probably more time with Muslims than I do Christians. No offense, guys. Y'all are great, okay? But I regularly go to mosques, I regularly visit with Muslims across the world. I've been able to get to know Muslims from Jordan to Cuba, from Canada to South Africa, from Indonesia to Germany, and many places in between. And I've loved the journey of getting to know people of other faiths, people of other perspectives, people of other beliefs and practices. And I'm hoping to share a little bit of that with you today, because I am assuming that you know a little bit about what religious diversity is. Otherwise, you wouldn't be in this session right now, unless maybe your leader told you you needed to. But you get this. You grew up in a world that is, by definition, religiously diverse. Your generation is one of the most diverse generations in U.S. history. And there's some good numbers to back this up, right? So, what we're experiencing today is what I referenced earlier as the shift from privilege to plurality. Christians used to enjoy a privilege in the United States. We just kind of assumed that culture, politics, society, entertainment, art, all these different things, if they weren't explicitly Christian, would at least be respectful towards Christianity, or would have some form of Christian element or inspiration to them. But now what we encounter is a diversity of different beliefs and postures and practices from people who are not Christian, some people who are actively anti-Christian, some people that you may firmly disagree with, not get along with, and think that their eternal fate is in question. How do you deal with that? How do you navigate that? The religious landscape of America has changed radically in the past 30 years, but most of us have not yet begun to see the dimensions and scope of that change. So gradual has it been, and yet so colossal, and it's an astonishing new reality. This is from Diana Eck at Harvard University. And what she's hinting at here is this shift from privilege to plurality has somehow caught us by surprise. And I'd venture to think that your church, your community, doesn't necessarily know what to do with this, doesn't necessarily know how to navigate this. And I hope as today we're able to explore a little bit of that together. This is a cool map. I like maps. Who likes maps? Fantastic. You're a fan of this slide. This is a map that shows the second largest religious tradition in each state. This is from 2010. We haven't quite updated it for 2020. But find your state. Find it somewhere on there. And so Christians are still in the majority in pretty much every U.S. state. That is true. But you've got green. Can anybody guess what green is? Those up front, you can read it probably. What is it? Islam, okay? So maybe you live in a state where the second largest religion is Islam. How about pink? Beautiful pink color is Judaism, exactly right. This burnt okra red is Hinduism, okay? Arizona, I love it because this is the colors of Arizona State. Fantastic, okay? They knew what they were doing here. Orange-ish, kind of burnt orange UT colors is Buddhist. And then South Carolina, okay? The second largest religious tradition there is the Baha'i. And maybe you didn't know this about your state. Maybe you didn't know this was the second largest religious community where you were. These are your neighbors. This is the people you live with, the people you study with, people that are in your family, maybe the people that used to be part of your church, people you work with, people you know. And like I said, you have an inkling about this. For Generation Z, which most of you are probably part of, American religious life has been defined by its diversity, and religious pluralism has been as much practice as principle, says my colleague Daniel Cox, which means you not only have to deal with the fact that demographically it is true that the religious profile of the United States is more diverse than it has ever been. That's kind of a theoretical, abstract thing. But you have to live this in daily life, right? You've got your Muslim friend and your Hindu neighbor, and you've got your Buddhist conversation partner when you're playing games online. You have to learn how to have these conversations to build these relationships. And how do you navigate them? Well, the hope is today, as we try to navigate what it is to live in a world where this is the religious makeup, where more and more people are secular or of some other religious identification, is how do we, as Christians, very specifically as followers of Jesus, navigate this shift from privilege to plurality, from being someone who is in the majority to being a minority among minorities? That's not something we're used to. It's not something we've done a lot of. So how do we do it? How does a Christian navigate religious diversity? The end point, I hope, is that we will come away with an appreciation for the fact that we are not called to love our Buddhist, Muslim, Hindu, or spiritual but not religious neighbor in spite of being Christian, but because we are Christian. And we would see in them the image of God, created by him and looking for him, just like us. The good news is that Jesus lived in a religiously diverse world. So we've got some good material to lean back on as we try to navigate this shift from privilege to plurality. Now, a lot of you may not initially think that Jesus lived in a religiously diverse world. Maybe you think, oh, Jesus just kind of lived in what kind of world? What would you guess? Jewish, right? Yeah, it's just a Jewish world. Well, what if I told you that Judaism didn't exist in Jesus' day? Yeah, I mean, you often heard it, that Jesus was a Jew, right? Yeah. Well, Judaism as we have it today didn't really exist. People in religious studies point out the fact that Judaism didn't start to exist until the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, right? And Jesus lived before 70 AD. And so Jesus lived in a time of what has been called proto-rabbinic Judaism. So it's the kind of Judaism that we've come to know more lively today, but it was still in its formation. And there were lots of different groups. Let's see how many of these groups you can name. Some of the different groups that were alive in Jesus' day that were helping to form what became modern rabbinic Judaism. Can you name any of them? Pharisees, Sadducees. I'm immediately thinking of this song. I just want to be a sheep. Ba, 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 right? I don't want to be a Sadducee because they're so sad, you see. Oh my God, that's a classic, okay? So, fantastic. So Sadducees and Pharisees. What else do we got out there? Zealots. We got some zealots. We got some, I heard the good one over here, the Essenes. Exactly right. So you had Sadducees, you had Samaritans, you had Essenes, you had zealots. That's right. So Samaritans. We know them right too. What religion were Samaritans? Starts with an S, ends with an Ameritan. Samaritan, exactly right. They were kind of like the religion of the Sadducees and the Pharisees and this proto-rabbinic Judaism, and yet because of their historical relationship with the community that Jesus was raised in, they also had their own place of worship. They had their own style. They would be treated as someone who was not of the same religion, not of the same ethnicity, not of the same culture that Jesus was raised in and knew. What other religions were perhaps at work in Jesus' day that you can think of? The Roman Empire and its imperial cult, their various Roman deities that had been kind of picked up and hijacked from Egyptian spirituality and Greek mythology, etc. Exactly. There were tons of Greek religious influences, right? People talking about fate, doing stuff with astrology and magic and sorcery and stoicism and mystery cults. It was a wild world of religion that Jesus lived in. It wasn't just a Jewish world, but a Jewish world in formation and with Samaritans and Romans and Greek religious mystery philosophy cult stuff mixed in for fun. So Jesus lived in a religiously diverse world. And as his disciples followed him, learning what the Jesus way was, he led them into this world of religious diversity. He talked and he dined with Pharisees and Sadducees. There were zealots among his followers. He knew Essenes. He sat with Samaritans. He chatted with Romans. He healed them. He taught them. He fed them. And he led his disciples to do the same. One of my favorite sections of Scripture to talk about this is in Mark chapter 5. It's known often as the story of Jesus and the Gerasene demoniac. Anybody know this story? Okay. Oh, fantastic. We got some people saying no. So you're going to learn something. You're going to at least get your money's worth from today's session. You will learn one thing. So what's going on in Mark chapter 3 and 4 is that Jesus is leading his disciples on a particular journey. He's taking them to a particular place. He is challenging his disciples to expand their moral and spiritual imagination beyond what they were raised with, beyond what they thought they knew, beyond the communities of comfort that they were already part of. And in Mark chapter 3 and 4, we see that a great crowd is following Jesus from Galilee to Judea and to Jerusalem and to places like Idumea and then beyond the Jordan and then to Tyre and Sidon. Now, all of those different names of different cities and places may not mean much to you, but you know that religious diversity that we just went through? of all the Sadducees and Pharisees and the Zealots and the Samaritans and the Romans and the Greek stuff. Well, all these different cities were plot points where these different religious communities had higher concentrations. And so if you went beyond the Jordan, or you went to the other side of the Jordan, maybe you'd end up in an area called the Decapolis, the area known as the Ten Cities, where Greek philosophy and mystery cults and Roman religion were more prevalent than this proto-rabbinic Judaism that Jesus was comfortable in places like Jerusalem and Judea. And then when you went north from there to Samaria, obviously, what would you run into? Samaritans. It's kind of what happens. You go to Mexico, who do you meet? Mexicans, right? You probably also meet a lot of Americans in Tijuana, but that's a whole other thing. But Jesus was taking his disciples and his different followers to all these different places and teaching them what it meant to follow Jesus in those places where they were not in the majority, where they were probably uncomfortable, where they probably disagreed with folks, didn't understand what they believed, and were uncomfortable with what was going on around them. In the midst of that, in Mark chapter 3 and 4, Jesus is teaching these parables about seeds and lamps and asks them the hard question, how then will you understand all the parables? How will you understand these things that I am teaching you about the kingdom of God? And he leaves that question kind of hanging there, and then the next thing he says to his disciples is, let us go across to the other side. How will you understand these parables of the kingdom of God? And then Jesus says, let us go across to the other side. At that time, Jesus was standing on the western shores of the Sea of Galilee. And as he pointed, let us go to the other side, he was talking about crossing the Sea of Galilee to go over into an area that was around Gerasa and was known as the Decapolis, as I mentioned earlier. The city, or this 10 cities, where Greek philosophy, Greek mystery cults, Roman religion were much more prevalent than what these good proto-Jewish boys were raised with back on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And as Jesus invites them to go over to the other side, they're immediately going, ah, Jesus, again? We have to go to another place where we're feeling uncomfortable, where we don't know what's going on. As a little boy, my mom always told me not to go there, to not have conversations with those people, to not hang out with them, to not go to the other side. And here's Jesus inviting me to do it yet again. And they hop into the boat, they go across, and as they're crossing the Sea of Galilee, what happens? A massive storm hits, right? Now, one of the things about the Sea of Galilee that was a popular belief at the time was that at the very bottom of the Sea of Galilee was actually a portal into the underworld. There was a prevalent belief that there was the entrance into what was known as the abyss, a place where you would go and you'd be among the land of the dead. And so as Jesus was going over to the other side with his disciples and they were like full of fear and full of questions and wondering why Jesus was taking them there again, what happens? But a storm hits. And they're fearful that the boat is going down. And they must go, Jesus, of course this was going to happen. God does not want us to go there. He's trying to be very clear about it. We may lose our lives. We may lose our eternal souls. We may go down to the very depths of the abyss. What are you doing to us? Jesus yawns, wakes up from his nap, tells the sea and the waves and the wind to stop, and then goes back to take a nap. Jesus communicates to them, I know you are full of fear. Going to the other side is not easy, but I got this. I got this. Now, they get to the other side, and what happens in Mark chapter 5? Anybody have your Bibles? You can feel free to open them up and check this out. But I love this moment where the disciples are probably tired from all this travel. Jesus is teaching them parables. He's asking them hard questions. They don't necessarily know what's going on. He's invited them to go to the other side. They probably didn't get any sleep because they were afraid of dying as they cross the Sea of Galilee. And then they get to the other side, and who greets them there? A man filled with 10,000 demons, hanging out in a cemetery and almost butt naked. And you know what? I feel like Peter. It would probably be Peter who would turn to Jesus and he'd be like, I told you, we should not go here. Let's get back in the boat, abyss or not, and go back to home. So there they are in a cemetery in the midst of death itself. Mom had told them never to go over here. And this, they're running around, and there's a herd of pigs in the area. Pigs, of course, being unclean, uncouth, untouchable for good proto-Jewish boys. And there's also a man filled with 10,000 demons around them. This is an area that some people say is where Jesus took his disciples. And I was here a few years ago. We're not sure if this is the actual place, but it kind of fits some of the description that's there. It's in the area that was around where Jesus could have taken him on the Sea of Galilee. That's the Sea of Galilee there, and this is the hill. And as Jesus is talking to the man filled with demons, and they're having a conversation, and then the demons are aware of who Jesus is. And then what does Jesus do with the demons that are inside the man? He casts them into the pigs and invents deviled ham. That's all I got for jokes, folks, okay? That's all I got. That's really all I got. It's just really bad dad jokes is all I got. So he casts them into the pigs. And of course, Peter's saying there, he's like, yeah, that's the only place demons could go, into the pigs. And then what does Jesus do? He takes the pigs, and the pigs run off the cliff and straight into the abyss. So Jesus has taken his disciples on a journey. From Mark chapter 3 and 4 and 5, he has introduced them to all different types of perspectives. He has spoken to them in parables. He has asked them hard questions. He has taken them to the other side. They have faced the abyss and demons and death and pigs. And Jesus was able to handle it all. In the shift from religious privilege as Christians to plurality, you may be afraid. You may have questions. You may not understand what's going on. Why do people believe the things they believe? Why do people do the things they do? Why do they think and act differently than me? Who's right? What's the fate of everyone who has ever lived? Are we wrong? Are they right? It can be tough. It can be confusing. And yet here is Jesus inviting us as Christians to go to the other side. In the midst of confusion, in the midst of doubt, in the midst of not understanding what is going on, in the midst of being told by our parents and others not to go there, not to do that, not to have relationships with those people, because what you will meet is a demoniac butt naked in a cemetery over there. And yet Jesus says, in the midst of all that, I got this. Follow me to the other side. In my life, I have a pretty lucky job. I pinch myself most of the time that I get to do what I do. I'm an LCMS pastor, but I don't work in a church. I go to church, but I don't work at the church. I work as a religious studies professor and a religion journalist, which means I get to hang out and talk with people of other religious perspectives all the time. And I get to ask them questions about what they believe and what they do and how they act and why they act that way. What are they doing about this problem in the world? Or how do they respond to hard questions about what people in their faith are doing? And a lot of these people have become very dear friends to me. People closer to me than some of my family. And one of them is a guy named Muhammad. And Muhammad is here. He's wearing my hat, okay? Because it was hot, and this is in the midst of Ramadan, where he was fasting, and we decided to take him out into 102-degree heat, where he couldn't drink any water. And I said, I'll give you my hat. But there he is talking to my wife, Paula, who's an Arabic teacher. So she speaks fluent Arabic, fluent German, fluent English, and here she was talking Arabic to Muhammad. And we are actually standing on an architectural site known as Qais in Jordan, and it's in the very north of Jordan. And you might ask, what are they looking at? So they're looking out across to the Sea of Galilee. And just on the opposite side of these hills is that picture I showed earlier of the spot where Jesus possibly led his disciples to go, where they ran into the demon-filled man in the cemetery. And as we were sitting there and talking, Muhammad was telling me, as a Palestinian who lived in Jordan, about the difficulties that exist between Palestinians and Israelis, between Israelis and Palestinians, of the animosity and the divide and the violence and the death. Muhammad has friends and family who have lost their lives because of that conflict, lost their homes. Muhammad also has friends and family who've taken lives, who have destroyed homes. In his life, religious diversity is deadly. And as we sat there and we looked from the other side to where Jesus and his disciples perhaps felt at home, I had a conversation with Muhammad about how it is we might navigate this together. How it is that he and I, coming from two different religions, might be able to make peace in this world or figure these things out together. And we ask questions like this. How do we enter into conversations with people who believe and do things differently, who see the world from another perspective, who live on the other side? As we continue today, I'm going to offer you up some postures and practices and then some very particular things that you might be able to put into your life as you navigate the shift from Christian privilege to Christian plurality. And the first is this little three-pronged set of postures, which are also related to practices that I like to share with other people. And the first is to listen and learn. Listen and learn. I want you to be able to lean into relationships and opportunities to learn more about others' beliefs, practices, and communities. This is an opportunity for you to learn more about the world. How wonderful it is that our world is so diverse. How beautiful it is that people believe, act, and do differently than we do. Diversity should not invite defensiveness. Diversity should invite curiosity. It should invite questions. It should invite learning and growth to see why people believe other things than we do. Why they do things differently than we might be prone to. To listen and learn from others is a beautiful gift. And the way we can do that is to enter into dialogue, to look for opportunities to engage in a conversation of life, action, and experience. You may think, or you may have a picture of religious or dialogue between people of different religious convictions as people sitting around and talking about the Bible and the Quran or the Rig Veda and the Torah. And yeah, that's part of dialogue. But more often, dialogue between people of different religions happens in the context of life, happens in the context of day-to-day interactions. One of my favorite stories is with my friend Al-Adin. So Al-Adin is a Muslim's Muslim. He's a qadi or a judge. He's a hafiz, which means he has memorized the entirety of the Quran and can recite it from memory. How many of you know, like, maybe one Bible verse by heart? Yeah, right. Like, I can get maybe one right on a good day, okay? And I'm a pastor, for Pete's sake. But imagine memorizing an entire book, okay? And you can't choose Philemon. It's off the book. Imagine just memorizing one book. How about a section of it? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Could you get that? How about all the prophets? I mean, it's wild. And here, Al-Adin knows the entirety of the Quran. It was so much fun because he can recite it from memory. So when he and I were studying Islamic studies together at the University of Florida, I'd turn to him and I'd say, Al-Adin, I can't remember where Ayat al-Kursi or the throne verse is. Could you tell me? And he would say, La ilaha illallah, and then he'd start reciting it immediately in Arabic. And I'd be like, okay, now translate that for me, bro, okay? But Al-Adin became a really good friend of mine while we were studying together at the University of Florida. And I got to ask him tons of questions about Islam as I was learning about it in school, but then learning about it also in life with him. And one of our favorite things to do was to go out to eat. We travel all over Florida. We went to Miami together. We went up to Atlanta. And we loved to grab a good bite to eat together. And one time we were eating at a restaurant in Gainesville, Florida, where we were both going to the University of Florida, and went to a Chinese restaurant. And one of the things you need to know about Al-Adin as well is that he was a big man, okay? I'm not a big man, but he was a very big, imposing man. He had a lot of eating to do. So we'd often go to buffets, and he would order the buffet at this Chinese restaurant, and then I ordered a single plate. And he got the buffet and he did his thing, and then we come over together and I ordered my one plate of mushu pork and we sat down. And we'd often talk and chat, ask hard questions, and then I'd be like, oh, what are you eating there? And what are you eating there? Oh, yeah, try some of this. And so I looked at him and I said, hey, Aladdin, you want to try some of this mushu pork? And he said, nah, Ken, I'm okay. I said, what's the deal, man? We always share each other's food. Like, why don't you try my mushu pork? And he says, no, Ken, I'm really okay. Now, some of you might be getting what's happening here. And I look at Aladdin, and I'm like, Aladdin, you're being weird. You're being rude, man. Why don't you have some of my mushu pork? And he looked at me and he said, Ken, I don't know if you remember this, but I'm Muslim, and Muslims don't eat pork. And I died. I just died and melted into the booth and became part of that sticky substance on the floor that no one wanted to ask questions about, okay? I was just mortified. Mortified. Here I am getting a PhD in Islamic studies, and I just offered my best Muslim friend mushu pork. I don't deserve it. I'm a horrible human being. And so the rest of the meal was just kind of weird. It was awkward. He went to the bathroom. I asked for the bill, paid it, of course. And then he came back and I said, I need to talk to him. I need to apologize for this. But before I could get it out, he sits down, he looks at me, all like, I don't know, 200 and something pounds of him. And he says, Ken, we need to talk. And I was like, oh no, here it comes. The friendship's over and I've ruined it. And I'm going to lose my buddy Aladdin, who is going to be able to recite the Quran for me when I'm studying for exams. I don't know. And he says, Ken, I want to thank you for earlier. I said, thank me? Are you kidding me? That was so rude of me. And he said, no, shut up. I want to thank you, because when you offered me that mushu pork, you didn't think of me as Aladdin the Muslim. You didn't think of me as Aladdin as the Qadi, as the Hafiz. He said, you just thought of me as Aladdin the friend who you wanted to try some of your mushu pork. I was like, ah, Aladdin, that's beautiful. Thank you, man. He said, one more thing. Never do it again. We have opportunities like this to do the dialogue of life, to live in relationships with others, to offer them pork, totally blow it, and to be forgiven by them in the process of day-to-day life. And so doing dialogue with people of other religious convictions is not hard. It's not difficult. It's super easy. Just be who you are. Have fun. Eat the pork. Don't offer it to your Muslim friends. But you can also do other things together. One of the coolest programs that I know about is, has any of you ever done Habitat for Humanity? Anybody ever done that before? Okay, yeah, you've gone out and built houses. You know that there are interfaith habitat programs where you can go build a house with people of a different religion. I tell you what, no one gets closer with someone of a different religion when you are both in danger of nailing your finger to a piece of wood, okay? That is a moment that brings you into life together. And it's a beautiful opportunity to talk about really deep, really difficult questions in the context of doing something pretty normal, pretty everyday. Putting together pieces of wood, painting a wall, trying to attach a gutter, adding some rocks out in front of someone's home. So look for opportunities to engage with people in the dialogue of life, not just the dialogue of deep theological questions. The third posture that I hope you are able to adopt is to remember that confession does not equal conquest. I want you to be Christians. Don't hear me wrong, okay? I'm a Christian. I'm a Lutheran pastor. I preach. I do sermons. I like being Lutheran. That's why I'm here hanging out with you guys, okay? I want you to have a firm faith. I want you to be convicted of your beliefs, to love Jesus, to be loved and known by him. That's what I want for you. I don't want you to be a jerk about it. We can have our confession, we can have our conviction, and yet still have honoring relationships with other people that are marked by humility and empathy and curiosity and love and generosity rather than hate and anger and argumentation. I cannot tell you how many times I have walked into rooms with people of other religious beliefs, and they love me as a Christian. They get along with me as a Lutheran. They invite me into the conversation around the table to connect with them and to try to figure out some of life's biggest problems. It's an honor to be at the table with them. But oftentimes I hear story after story after story of how these people have been burnt by Christians. How Christians have come at them. It's like the first thing that Christians do. They're like, "Hi, I'm Craig. Have you been washed in the blood of the Lamb?" You know, it's like, you don't have to be like that. You can have your convictions. You can have your confession. You can witness to the worldview. You can tell your Muslim friends, your Jewish friends, your Buddhist friends about Jesus, and I hope you do. But be winsome about it. Winsome is a word that means to be attractive by very nature. And I mean, all of you, I've been looking at you for the last 30 minutes or so. You're all attractive by nature, okay? You're all good-looking people. But I'm talking in spirit and in emotion and in the way you carry yourself. To give a winsome witness to Christianity by being curious, by asking questions, by connecting with people, by living life together. To give your consistent presence to people of other religious convictions, to be committed to human liberation and your own liturgical life at the same time. It can be done. To be engaged in prayer and contemplation, but also to be able to proclaim and to teach others about Christianity along the way when you're invited and asked to do so. Now, you will face some difficult things along the way as you try to wade into the difficult world of interreligious dialogue. There are several different things that can go wrong. A, your own religious illiteracy. This is no offense against you, beautiful, smart people, but several years ago, the Pew Research Center put out a strange survey. Maybe some of you did it. But they put out a religious knowledge quiz. They asked like 10 to 15 basic questions. Okay? Like, who is it that was said to have carried the Ten Commandments down from Mount Sinai? Do you know? Moses. Yeah, okay, fantastic. One out of one. Killing this quiz so far, my friends. Okay? Who is the main character in the Gospels? Jesus. Who is the prophet of Islam? Muhammad. What is the main text of the Hindu traditions? It just took a turn, okay? So they asked basic questions like this. Now, you got the Moses, you got the Jesus, you got the Muhammad. Then there were some more difficult ones about Buddhism, like what are the four noble truths of Buddhism? Right, okay? Now, out of all the people that they administered this test to, when they took the aggregate scores, do you know what the average score was? Out of 10 questions. 3, 2, y'all are pessimists. I tell you what. It was 3.7. That was the average. That is not good, okay? This is not golf. A lower score is not better. 3.7. Do you know who performed the best on this, in terms of a religious group, if it was like Jews, Christians, Muslims, atheists? Muslims? No, it was atheists. Atheists got the best score. And all my atheist friends, if you were in my atheism session, I got lots of atheist friends, and they were all bragging to me like, "Ken, we did the best on this quiz. We get all the religions, but we reject them. Like, we're awesome." I was like, "What was your average score?" And they were like, 53%. And I'm like, "Y'all are so smart. You know that's an F, right?" Like, so everyone across the board, regardless of their religious convictions, failed a basic quiz in religious literacy. And so the first thing we need to do, again, listen and learn. Grow in your knowledge and understanding of other religious traditions. Go to the other side, sit and learn about what Muslims believe, what Buddhists do, how Hindus live life. You also need to deal with the fact that Christianity has long been involved with colonialism and conquest. I know this is an uncomfortable thing to say, and there's lots of conversations out there about this now in these days, and you may have heard some different things. But the truth is that for a long time, Christian missionaries, even people with well-intentioned purpose, even people just trying to do the work of sharing Jesus' love with others, often went on the same ship as soldiers and colonial officials who did horrible things. And sometimes the Christian missionaries did them too. I've been in too many places in the world and heard too many stories from people's families and people's histories and people's traditions. I've seen too many churches built on the rubble of temples that existed before in a way to say, yeah, Christianity's better. And it has not left a good witness. So you will sometimes run into conversations with people of other religious traditions, and you will have to deal with the difficult history of Christianity's colonial conquest. You're also going to have to deal with the fact that religion can be hard to define. Do you know that most Hindus would not say they are religious? Yeah, they don't call Hinduism a religion. We call it a religion. We look at it as a religion. But most Hindus would say, yeah, I'm an atheist. And you may think, no, but wait, there's like one thing I know about Hinduism, and that is they have like a million bajillion gods, okay? And you're right. But at the same time, there's a Hindu philosophy that says there is no God. And yet there are many gods. Ask, learn more. Why don't they call it a religion? Why do they say there is no God and yet there are many gods? Why do they have an elephant-headed one? Okay, like, yeah, lean into those conversations and figure it out. And maybe change your conception of what religion is. The thing is, religious studies, the very study of religion itself, came out of Christian theological programs at universities. And so basically what these Christian professors did is they looked at other things and said, that looks kind of like Christianity, that looks kind of like Christianity, that looks kind of like Christianity, we'll call it religion. Because that's what we have. And all the other people were like, yeah, but no. And so one of the first things we have to deal with is trying to understand what religion is itself. We're also going to have to deal with tribalism and raising flags. What do I mean by that? Last night at the mass event, I watched something very funny. So I'm an anthropologist by training, which is I study humans and look at them a lot and then write books about it, okay? And I watched y'all when Zach started talking about hamburgers. And, I mean, it almost got bloody in there, okay? Like, it was a dangerous place. I was looking for the exit. I was walking slowly away because I had that group of Butterburger people in front of me, and I thought they were going to straight up murder folks, okay? They're like, if he says In-N-Out, I am going to hurt him, okay? Y'all turned tribal real quick over hamburgers. It's meat, cheese, bread, maybe some toppings. It's not a big deal. Yeah, well, yes, it is. Now, I'm from California. Don't get me started on tacos, okay? I get it. But how funny it is that all you have to do at an event like this with loving, beautiful Christians is mention hamburgers. And you're ready to cut people, okay? But the thing is, we so quickly will raise our flags. This is our identity. This is who we are. Butterburgers are the only thing to eat. And we're not even talking about whether or not Christianity is true, whether to follow Jesus or not, and what's the fate of every person who has ever lived. It's so easy to so quickly get tribal, to talk about us, to talk about them, how they're wrong and we're right. And I will not talk to them. I will not be with them. I will not go to the other side. I will not eat their burger. It's easy to do. Don't do it. They will know we are Christians by our love. The other one is the apathy gap. A lot of you are probably like, yeah, I don't care. I get it. I have a weird job. I do this because I love it. You're all probably not going to do the same thing. But here's the deal, folks. We have no choice. Christianity is shrinking. Other religions are growing. Christianity is also growing in the global south. Don't get me wrong. Christianity is like going bonkers in Asia, in the Middle East, in sub-Saharan Africa, in Latin America. Christianity is just going to look different than us white people for the most part, okay? I know there are people who are not white here, but I mean, Pew Research also does this thing where we're like 98.97% white in the Lutheran Church. So Christianity is changing before our very eyes, okay? But we have to be able to navigate this shift from privilege to plurality. We have to be able to figure out how we can relate to people who believe differently than us, who act differently than us, who have different perspectives on the ultimate fate of all things than us. We need to learn how to not love someone of another religion in spite of being Christian, but because we are Christian. Some practical next steps that you might be able to do in your church or your community as we close together today. First, get to know someone of another faith tradition. If you do not have a Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, atheist friend, try it out. Again, don't be creepy, okay? You're gonna be like, so I went to this youth gathering in Houston, Texas, and this one pastor guy told me to be friends with a Muslim. Do you want to come over? Okay, don't do that. That's not what I want. That's not what I'm telling you. Be cool about it. If you go up and you're like, hey, I'd like to learn more about your religion, and they're like, that's the last thing I want to do, be like, cool, have a great day, okay? Don't be like, I must, okay? But yeah, get to know someone of a different faith tradition. You're so often told not to go to the other side. Good Christian boys and girls don't talk to those kind of people. Do it anyways. You're fine. Jesus has got this. He's in control. He has the wind and the waves and the water and the demoniac and the pigs under his control. He'll figure it out. We have the God of the universe on our side. We can be friends with people we disagree with. Second, try out a religious site visit. Go to a mosque. Check out a Hindu temple. Hang out in a synagogue. Do it as a church group. It's fun. It's also weird and awkward, and you have to take off your shoes, and there might be incense, and you're going to be like, whoa, they have that elephant-headed God in this room. That is wild. It'll be fun. You'll get to do these things we talk about, to listen and learn, to dialogue and do together, and to have those conversations in a very intimate setting. Or do this, a house of worship exchange. Now, I'm not talking about going to an actual service of another tradition. That's not something I'm inviting you to do, because that's something that is very sacred, is very different, and can get very confusing if you show up at their religious tradition or their religious service. But what I am inviting you to do is have them come over and check out your church after you've gone and visited their mosque. It's always been super fun when I've had my Muslim friends come to my church. My friend Aladdin came to my ordination as an LCMS pastor. And as he was sitting in the back of the room, like a good Lutheran, you know, I could just see his eyes getting so wide when all these men with beards and wearing white robes and red scarves came and put their hands on my head as I was kneeling beneath them. And he was like, what are they about to do to Ken? He had so many questions afterwards. It was such a lovely conversation. So try it out. Go to their place. Invite them over to your place. Like friends do. Fourth, participate in a dialogue event. Host something of your own. That's number five. Maybe invite a guest speaker, someone from a different religious tradition, to come and teach you about what they believe. Don't rely on your pastor, your DC, or your well-intentioned volunteer to teach you about every religion in the world through a world religions Bible study. That is asking too much. Go to the source. Go to the people who actually believe and do this stuff. Again, it's okay to learn. It's okay for them to have you sit at their feet and to have them teach you. Get involved with interreligious activism, like building a Habitat for Humanity home, or addressing things like climate change or religious conflict together with people of other faiths. It is a good thing for us to do, especially as Lutherans, to lean into relationships where we're trying to fix the world's problems with people who believe differently than us. This is something Lutherans have historically done very well. So I invite you to try it out. And eighth, advocate for religious freedom. Bishop Thomas Schirmacher, who is the leader of the World Evangelical Alliance, it's one of the largest associations of evangelical Christians across the world. There's about 60 million people who are part of the World Evangelical Association. He is a leader in religious freedom advocacy, and he says, nobody can be free to practice their religion until everybody is free to practice their religion. And so he doesn't mean that religious freedom is so that we can pray in schools or that we can do certain things as Christians and try and not have that loss of privilege so we can regain it back. But he says people should be allowed to convert to different religions, to choose a different religion, to believe and do as they please. And he works with Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus to advocate for that so that people can change their religion from one to another. And we should be advocating for the same. And I know that's dangerous, that's vulnerable. Are we inviting people to leave Christianity? No. It gives us the opportunity to invite people to Christianity and for them to be able to do it freely. As we close today, I want to close with a prayer and an invitation. So the one is, reach out. You may have more questions. This is my website. This is my Insta. This is my Twitter. I am so not cool enough to be on other social media, okay? I'm an old man. I stopped at Instagram, okay? But you can get a hold of me here. And as you write those down, join me in prayer for a moment. God of all existence, God of the cosmos, God of this side and the other side, God of all things, may we see you at work in our world of diversity, inviting us to lean into relationships with people who believe, act, and confess something different than we do. May we listen and learn, dialogue and discern what we may do together for the sake of your kingdom. May we see in the faces and faiths of every person, Buddhist and Muslim, atheist and Mormon, Hindu and Methodist, an opportunity to grow in our own faith and in our understanding and appreciation of the cosmos you've created. May we not face the shift from privilege to plurality with a spirit of fear, but one of empowered love and sound mind. May we be known for loving others, not in spite of being Christian, but because we are. Amen. Thank you very much.